Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Throughout our history, first ladies have embraced many kinds of roles besides that of a hostess who welcomes visiting dignitaries and organizes banquets and redecorates the White House. Early on, some began to use the position to further political and social causes, women's rights and abolition, education and housing, to name a few, from the 19th century alone. But some are better known for their causes than others. For example, Nancy Reagan's Just Say No anti-drug campaign has become iconic.
Not long ago in Oakland, California, I was asked by a group of children what to do if they were offered drugs. And I answered, just say no. Soon after that, those children in Oakland formed a Just Say No club. And now there are over 10,000 such clubs all over the country.
A new two-season documentary series, First Ladies, Influence and Image, premieres this weekend on C-SPAN. To take a closer look at their impact over the years, joining us now to talk about that is Mark Farkas. He's executive producer of C-SPAN Specials. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you, Ann. Good to be with you.
Also with us is Richard Norton Smith. He's an historian at George Mason University and the former head of five presidential libraries and one of four historical advisors for the project. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Thank you very much.
We often talk about the political role of First Ladies evolving over the years, but we're really talking about the public role, depending on the relationship from the beginning. First Ladies have had the ear of one of the most powerful people in the world, right, Richard?
Well, they have, and in fact, that's a unique kind of influence. You know, there's this debate that goes on, rages among scholars. I don't think the public cares, quite frankly, as much about you know, the most influential first ladies. And someone like an Eleanor Roosevelt is an obvious example, someone who had her own radio show, someone who began holding press conferences on a regular basis, someone who indeed, as you indicated, embraced a number of causes. Her influence was immense and it was public. Her successor was Bess Truman. Bess Truman didn't have press conferences. Bess Truman didn't have a radio show. Bess Truman had something else, though. She had the ear of the President of the United States, and that is a unique influence and a unique position in a town where proximity means everything.
Let's listen to a clip of Eleanor Roosevelt describing one of her greatest achievements.
The thing I remember giving me the greatest pleasure was at the end of the first session in London of the United Nations. I had gone in fear and trembling, and I had felt that I had to walk very carefully because I was the first woman on the delegation, and a woman must do well or it hurts all women.
Of course, she's talking about her role on the UN delegation. She was keenly aware of that role. Richard Norton Smith, was it because her immediate successor was not that way that it seemed like a long time before politics per se and that kind of an official role became appropriate for a first lady?
Well, you know, that's a great question. The great irony is, of course, Mrs. Roosevelt's talking about her work after the war, after FDR died, in the formation of the United Nations and the drafting of the Charter of International Human Rights and the like, which suggests something else about this job, and that is that the influence and the impact and the visibility of a first lady does not end when they leave the White House. I think of Betty Ford, who probably had considerably more impact on how ordinary people live their lives as a former first lady, someone who created the Betty Ford Center, which has become, you know, part of the popular language. Someone who made it possible for women in particular, but by no means exclusively women, to come to terms with drug dependency. Just as earlier, she had brought the subject of breast cancer out of the closet. And she said at the time, well, she was still in the hospital recovering from her operation, and she turned on the radio, and she heard stories about women all over America who were inspired by her example to go and get exams themselves. And it dawned on her in a way that it hadn't before that, you know, the First Lady, in fact, does potentially have this unique pedestal, if you will, this unique megaphone from which to, you know, call attention to causes that might otherwise go unnoticed.
We're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm talking with Richard Norton Smith. He's a presidential historian at George Mason University, also a consultant on a new C-SPAN special series that starts this weekend. It's called First Ladies, Influence and Image. We'll have a link for more information about that at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Also with us, Mark Farkas. He's the executive producer of the C-SPAN special series. Mark, I was looking through kind of a lot of lists of those fun facts to know and tell about the First Ladies, and there was a fun fact to know and tell about every single one of them, really. I guess some of them weren't as fun as others, but there was a fact. But did you ever worry? Were all of them equally rich in story enough for a series?
Well, if you look at them in total, I mean, it's an underexplored facet of American history, which is one of the reasons it intrigued us to do a series like this. I mean, there's been individual documentaries on Eleanor Roosevelt and Nancy Reagan. But as a whole, so many of these names have been lost to history, if history even remembers them in a textbook. And when Richard came to us with the idea, we looked around, said, why has nobody done anything on all of them? And then we started to ask the question that you just asked, is there enough there to do something like this? And the answer resoundingly was yes. I mean, almost every single one of these first ladies have fascinating stories to tell, some more fascinating than their husband. I think Richard made a good point in one of my conversations with him recently where, you know, sometimes they're more interesting people and they live more interesting lives because they're not bound by politics like their husbands are. So they're almost every single one of them have interesting stories to tell. And that, you know, for the ones that we think we know, there'll be surprises in the shows. But for so many of them, you know, I think of Julia Tyler. Again, if people even know her name, the entire program will be new. And so that's the thing that makes this fun for us.
And you know, it's funny. Think about Columbus. Think of all the, you know, Ohio presidents.
Mm-hmm.
Think of Lucy Hayes, who was the wife of Governor Rutherford B. Hayes, and who, while tending to her eight children and her husband, managed to take a real interest in public affairs, was in some ways the Governor Hayes' eyes and ears, traveling around the state, looking at state facilities, and taking a real interest in the idea, which was still radical at that time, that women had a real role to play in public affairs. Ida McKinley, you know, every very touching story. Every day, William McKinley from the governor's office in your state capitol would go to the window and wave his handkerchief, and Ida, sitting in their suite at the hotel across the street, would be reassured. I mean, there's an extraordinary love story there, a very tragic story about love and loss. And those are universal experiences, universal emotions. So as Mark says, this is not a series defined by political ambition, as a series about the presidents might be. It's much broader than that.
And Mark Farkas, to what extent, I mean, you must, and I'm sure you probably do, get into the context of their role as First Lady from the very beginning, and that plays a big role in it. But, you know, when you're getting into the 50s, you got a lot of television footage, you got, you know, film and radio sound and all kinds of stuff like that, probably in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. But before that, how are you illustrating these histories?
Well, season one, you know, takes us from Martha Washington through Ida McKinley, and you're right. We don't have recorded film and sound of these first ladies for the most part. But the great thing about so many of them is that they're letter writers. I mean, you take a look, you go back to Abigail Adams, who is writing constantly to John Adams, defending him in the press even while he's over in Europe during the Revolution. And then as First Lady continues to write. And so we have the letters of so many of these first ladies. And so that is a way to get to know them as people, to hear that, you know, to see what they wrote in their own words. I mean, I think of poor Jane Pierce, who loses her only surviving son, you know, a month before they come to Washington. She and Franklin Pierce watch their son Benny get his skull crushed on a train trip, and it taints her entire time as First Lady. She actually writes a letter to Benny after he's passed away, and leads with it by saying, "You will never see this." So these letters are a real way to make them come alive, I think. And so, like I said, so many of them have been letter writers, and that hasn't stopped. I mean, I think if you take a look at the books that Barbara Bush has written, they probably have sold a little bit better than George H.W. Bush's. So it's we've got a real advantage there. And then obviously, yeah, in season two, when you get into the film and television era, it's a whole new type of opportunity for us.
You mentioned Abigail Adams. And, you know, anyone who's followed any of her writings or letters are amazing. She was absolutely brilliant. Richard Norton Smith, is that pretty much the case across the board? Did they tend to be highly intelligent, brilliant women like her?
I mean, Abigail Adams stands out.
Yeah.
You know, she's in a class by herself. But, you know, you're allowed your question. The First Ladies, they're a very divergent group of people, and that's one of the interesting things. I would say probably more so than their husbands.
Mm-hmm.
They range in terms of interest, in terms of educational background, of course, was something that was very largely withheld from women for much of the early history of the Republic. And yet, Martha Washington, I mean, poor Martha Washington has suffered more than her husband from the kind of iconography gone amok. I mean, you know, I mean, she's everyone's plump grandmother, you know, and as if she were born looking like that. And
yeah,
the fact is, you know, this is a woman who was widowed when she was 25, who inherited the management of 5 farms, you know, who negotiated with her factors in London. I mean, this was a woman who had extraordinary, you might call practical intelligence, practical real-world experience in a way that I think will come as a real surprise to people who have this kind of cliche, not only about Martha Washington, but about the whole period. And then, of course, she had political instincts. She was more political, more overtly political than her husband. Of course, he couldn't afford to be. But the fact is, by the end of his years in office, Martha was a good, rip-roaring Federalist who wanted to see John Adams beat Thomas Jefferson in 1796 and be the Washington successor. So she got her wish.
My guests are Richard Norton Smith, presidential historian at George Mason University, and also Mark Farkas. He's the executive producer of a C-SPAN special series that begins this weekend. It's called First Ladies, Influence and Image. If you have a question or comment for either of our guests, you're welcome to join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The Oscar-nominated Zero Dark Thirty opens with a declaration that the story is based on firsthand accounts of actual events. But Senators Dianne Feinstein and John McCain say the film got it seriously wrong when it showed suspects giving up information under torture. I'm Neil Conan, Zero Dark Thirty, Osama bin Laden, and the new debate on torture. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. Increasing clouds today with a slight chance of rain, a high of 45. Cloudy skies tonight, a low of 28 degrees. A snow shower is likely for Friday, less than half an inch of accumulation, otherwise partly sunny and a high of 38 degrees. There's a chance of some light snow for Friday night as well, a low of 23. Support comes from ARC Industries, providing business solutions to Columbus's industrial, retail, and commercial markets, and helping people with disabilities find meaningful work. ARC Industries, dedicated to the success of its customers, employees, and the community. ARC Industries is online at arcind.com. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. This hour, we're talking about the role of the First Lady in American life. First ladies not only play a role in the day-to-day activities of the White House, they also can be instrumental in getting their husbands elected. Jacqueline Kennedy helped out during JFK's campaign for the presidency with a Spanish language campaign ad.
Queridos amigos, les habla la esposa del senador John F. Kennedy, candidato a la presidencia de los Estados Unidos.
Still with us to discuss First Lady is Mark Farkas. He's executive producer of the C-SPAN series First Ladies, Influence and Image, starts this weekend. Also with us is Richard Norton Smith, historian at George Mason University and the former head of five presidential libraries, one of four advisors for this project. So Jacqueline Kennedy, a standout, kind of a turning point, Richard?
Oh, sure. Remember, her husband was the youngest president ever following the oldest president, and you could look at on the distaff side. I mean, can you think of a greater contrast stylistically between Mamie Eisenhower with Mamie Bangs and Mamie Fudge and Mamie Pink and her daily soap operas and Jacqueline Kennedy? Mrs. Kennedy, who had a waspish wit, which people who have listened to her now on the tapes have a better idea of, she did say she didn't want to be called First Lady. It sounded like a racehorse. And she wasn't wild about the decorative scheme of the White House. When she went there for the first time to look around, she said it really looked like a bad summer hotel. And so I think maybe there was born at that moment her great idea of restoring the house.
She wasn't the first to restore the house, though. There was somebody back in time that would have been a crumbling mess if they hadn't gotten to it.
Oh, sure. I mean, well, poor Lucretia Garfield, who was only there for 6 months, started what she called the Bureau of Apartments, which was the first systematic effort to sort of chronicle the history, room by room, stick of furniture by stick of furniture, of the house. And then Mrs. Harrison, Caroline Harrison, came up with this extraordinary plan to build additions onto the White House, sort of where the East and West Wings are now, and Congress wouldn't appropriate the funds. But there's no doubt, you know, firstly, Mary Todd Lincoln, of course, took a lot of heat during the Civil War for spending $20,000 to refurbish the House. In fact, that's one of the recurring themes. You remember, you mentioned Nancy Reagan. Remember the brouhaha about the China.
Mm-hmm.
You know, never mind that no public funds were spent, that it was donated by a foundation, but America was in a recession, and it played into the image that some people had of Mrs. Reagan as a quasi-royal figure.
Mark Farkas, how much of the series do you spend in the White House?
Well, it's the reason, you know, they're First Ladies, so it's the focal point, and we want to really explore their time in the White House, what influence they had. But, you know, it's a good point. Part of what we want to explore as well is how they changed the White House.
Yeah.
And that could be physically. And, you know, I think of someone like Edith Roosevelt at the turn of the century, who basically says to Teddy and his, you know, his handlers, you know, we've got too big a family. We've got to get you out of here. And the West Wing comes out of that discussion. So, you know, we wouldn't have the West Wing and what people associate with the presidency these, you know, today without someone like Edith Roosevelt, who, by the way, when you think about all those great pictures of those kids, that rambunctious group going mm-hmm. through the White House, she's the one who hires the photographer. She's the one who gets the final say on what those images are that go out to the public. So I think it's a good example of a First Lady who really changes the White House, but also is on the cusp of this, you know, media management as well.
Preservationists, media managers, where would we be without the West Wing television show? What would they have called it? Pat in Upper Arlington, you're on the air with Mark Farkas of C-SPAN and also Richard Norton Smith, presidential historian. Welcome, Pat.
Hi. I just have two little references to make. One is, since I'm in my 80s, I certainly remember Eleanor Roosevelt, who had her own column called My Day. And she, you know, expounded on all her views, I think, about social justice and who knows what all. So she was just a woman in her own right, I would say. And the other thing I have to say is my late husband was on the Literacy Council. And Barbara Bush's philanthropic outreach, I guess you'd say, what she concentrated on was literacy. So she came to Columbus, and the Social Security was everywhere, and my husband happened to sit next to her. And in the course of the lunch, she said to my husband, "The Bush women are all pro-choice." And I thought, that just sounds like Barbara Bush, very outspoken. I don't think the Tea Party would probably like to hear that these days. But anyhow, it's interesting how many women we have. The beautification that Lady Bird Johnson was interested in. So it, I think it's wonderful that they each had their own little causes that they pursued separate and away and in addition to their husband's causes, let's say.
Well, would Richard, was that an imperative for them? Just we started the show at the top of the hour, I think, with a cut from Michelle Obama saying, you have to do it for survival, just to survive. I think she's talking about emotionally. You have to set yourself apart a little bit somehow.
Well, yeah, there's a couple issues here. Of course, the one is the bubble. The Obamas have talked with some eloquence about, you know, feeling almost imprisoned. And, of course, they have small children or young children, but not as young as they used to be. And so that's one factor. But the whole question you ask about having a cause, I would say really ever since Mrs. Roosevelt, it's become progressively more unimaginable to think of a first lady with no outside cause. The caller talked about Mrs. Johnson. You know, she hated the word beautification, but they could never come up with a better one. And, you know, but what she was, stop and think, what she was an environmentalist, you know, long before, you know, that cause really was widely embraced. And she also did, you know, something else, a very brave woman. In 1964, after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, it was very clear that her husband was not terribly popular among white Southerners. And Lady Bird Johnson got on a train. It was the Lady Bird Special, and campaigned from Virginia all the way down to New Orleans. And because she was, of course, a Southerner herself, and she made these wonderful talks from the whistle stop of the train throughout the Deep South, not only on behalf of her husband's campaign, but in a much larger sense about the need for Southerners to put the past behind them and to embrace racial equality. And that's a role that, you know, there's nothing in the Constitution. No one says this is the job for the First Lady, but that's what a brave, committed, caring First Lady can do on her own.
And she takes both of her daughters on that train trip with her. We did an interview with Lyndon Johnson Robb, and the epithets that were hurled at Mrs. Johnson along that train route, I mean, you just think, you can imagine what they would have said to her. And then the security was out in front of them with the train. So it was, you know, a difficult thing for her to do. But I think Richard's right. It's another aspect of these first ladies that you really don't think about that much.
Pat, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. If anyone else would like to give us a call, 614-292-8513. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. First ladies now, of course, as we mentioned earlier, play a big role on the campaign trail and at party conventions. It's a big deal, bigger than ever, it felt like this summer when they gave their speeches, sometimes even for candidates other than their husbands. Here's Laura Bush talking about the role of women at the 2008 GOP convention.
Played an important role in our party, from energizing grassroots to driving policy. Thank you to the dedicated women in our audience for making the Republican Party so strong.
Of course, this is, you know, an ongoing effort to make sure everybody knows that the Republican Party embraces women. But Laura Bush does not, for a lot of people, stand out as a strong, iconic standard bearer for women necessarily.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Go to Africa, where you know, her campaign, the PEPFAR campaign, the extraordinary effort and investment that the United States has made, really, with Mrs. Bush's leadership in the war on AIDS.
But the president, Bush, got most of the credit for that.
He did. He did. And so what you're saying is Mrs. Bush was self-effacing. There's a difference between being, in effect, self-effacing and not being actively involved. Give you an example. Think back to right after 9/11. You know, one of the roles that first ladies play, think of Jackie Kennedy and the majesty with which she basically led this grieving nation following the death of her husband. In times of great national trial, first ladies take on another role. Sometimes it's that of educator. Sometimes it's mourner. But certainly after 9/11, Laura Bush in some ways came into her own, talking particularly to children, to young people, and trying to allay their fears. It suggests that this job, for which there is no job description, is as personalized as a fingerprint. It depends upon the unique set of circumstances. No one could have predicted the events, say, of the Bush presidency, or for that matter, many others. And it's the ability of the First Lady to react to the unexpected that in many ways will define their place in history.
Mark Farkas, when do you first start showing the First Ladies in that kind of public political role of speaking at the conventions and that sort of thing?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we talked about Jackie Kennedy doing that and that great Spanish TV ad mm-hmm. that you had that you played. But you know, Mamie Eisenhower before that, women are finally in the 50s outnumber men in the voting populace, and Mamie Eisenhower is the first first lady to be on a television ad. So again, I think this notion of these first ladies being out there in front of the camera, it didn't just start with Michelle Obama at the Democratic convention. Obviously, I thought her speech was one of the best that we have at the convention. But in terms of in the film and television era, it really is. I mean, we've got great recordings of Lou Hoover, who is just when you again here's a name you associate Hoover with Herbert Hoover, but the Hoovers obviously had an amazing story to tell before they get to the White House. So we have recordings of her. We have recordings of Grace Coolidge, but they really don't take this, this public role of speaking at conventions. That is something more of a modern phenomenon.
In fact, it's a wonderful story. Grace Coolidge was a working woman. She had been a teacher at the Clark School for the Deaf in Northampton, Massachusetts, and she actually never did give a public speech as First Lady. Well, she was finally prevailed upon to make an exception, and of course, with her wry New England humor, she got up and she delivered the entire speech in sign language. Wouldn't you love to have footage of that?
But Ohio's own Lucy Hayes is the first lady, now so this was post-White House, to actually make a public speech, and the first first lady with a college education. And so I think, to me, that's one of the interesting things about the series as well. You know, the fact that here she is, the first first lady to be college educated, to me that begs a question, what is going on in the country at that time? How many other women are getting college educations? The temperance movement is happening at that time, as well as the suffrage movement. So, these first ladies are really a window into what's going on in the country at the time as well. And whether it's a public role that they take or a private role, to examine their lives, I think, is a window onto these different time periods.
Richard Norton Smith, you are a presidential historian, and you have been the former head of 5 presidential libraries. I've been to a few of them. To what extent is it important, or have you found it important, or to incorporate the life of the First Lady?
Oh, it's enormously important. And I'm pleased to say that the way that it's done is changing. For a long time, if you went to a presidential library, you'd find these little boxy galleries devoted to domestic policy and foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come to a room devoted to the First Lady.
Right.
And there'd be a bunch of dresses as of China. And then, you'd move on to the next room. But that's not real life. That's not how people live their lives. and it's not, quite frankly, it's not an accurate depiction of the various roles that modern first ladies play. So, for example, in the newest presidential libraries, the Bush Library that will be opening in Dallas, for example, in April, and in other libraries that have been redone, you find the story of the first lady integrated throughout. You know, the fact is, Eleanor and Franklin Roosevelt are a partnership. They are a team. And there used to be wings of the FDR Library devoted to Eleanor. Well, the library has been renovated, and instead of separate wings, that whole story has been brought where it belongs, on a par with FDR's story, and inseparable from that story.
And more first ladies are taking a very active role in these presidential libraries. Laura Bush called a meeting before they left the White House of the presidential library directors to basically say, what have you been doing? What can be improved in terms of
the former librarian herself?
Exactly. And we were actually just in Dallas last week to do a walkthrough with her. We're going to do a special on the new Bush Library that opens up April 25th. And she is completely hands-on in presenting the story, not only 9/11, but the story of the Bush presidency. So these first ladies are, you know, they're much more active now than they've ever been with these presidential libraries.
How many living first ladies are there now?
Well, you stop and think. You have Rosalind Carter, mm-hmm. Nancy Reagan, Barbara Bush, Hillary Clinton,
and Laura Bush,
and Michelle Obama. So we have six.
And did you feel a certain imperative, Mark Farkas, to get to the Nancy Reagans and the Barbara Bushes sooner rather than later?
Well, we've reached out to all the living first ladies, and we're going to be doing interviews with each one of them. Mrs. Reagan is at a point where she's not doing any more television interviews, but
right.
We have, over the years, done some really fascinating things with her that have been very personal and talks about her, how she approached the role of First Lady. And then, you know, Barbara Bush, we were at a conference down in Austin recently where she spoke along with Laura Bush. So we did tape her down there. But, you know, we don't get to some of these first ladies until, you know, the end of 2013, the beginning of 2014. So we'll definitely be doing things with each one of them.
We're talking about the history of the First Lady in the United States with Mark Farkas. He's the executive producer of a C-SPAN special series that begins this weekend. It's a two-season series. It's called First Ladies, Influence and Image. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Also with us, Richard Norton Smith. He's a presidential historian at George Mason University and was a consultant on an advisor, on the series. When we return, we'll continue. Got a question or comment? 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And you can tweet us at WOSU All Sides. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the rise and fall of the Ku Klux Klan. We talk with David Cunningham, author of Klansville, USA. We'll hear how the Klan started wearing sheets and hoods, burning crosses, and terrorizing African Americans. Cunningham will play us an excerpt of a speech recorded at a Klan rally and a recording by a popular Klan band. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon. Join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow when we catch up with State House News with a reporter's roundtable and then take a step behind the legend to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the birth of the OSU football coach Woody Hayes. Join us for that during All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow from 10 until noon here on 89.7 NPR News. And you can join WOSU TV for the 20th annual Champion of Children signature event and awards presentation. Sunday afternoon, watch as former WOSU radio host Fred Anderle talks with Jeffrey Canada, the creator of the Harlem Children's Zone, a nonprofit that supports children and families. Watch it Sunday afternoon at 1 on WOSU TV. 36 degrees with a slight chance of rain today, a high of 45. Support for 89.7 comes from the State Auto Insurance Companies, providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. We're talking about the history of the First Ladies in the United States with Mark Farkas. He's the executive producer of the C-SPAN special series, First Ladies, Influence and Image. Also with us, Richard Norton Smith. He's presidential historian at George Mason University and a frequent advisor to C-SPAN for its historical programs, including this upcoming series. Cynthia from Columbus wants us to talk about Rosalynn Carter and her contribution to mental health issues.
That's a great idea. Mrs. Carter, just as Mrs. Ford sort of brought the whole issue of alcohol and drug dependency to the fore, Mrs. Carter did that very much with mental health issues. And indeed, she testified before Congress. She became the first lady since Eleanor Roosevelt to actually testify before a congressional committee on this subject. And she took some heat. You know, first ladies have always taken heat when they veer into the public policy realm. Abigail Adams was mocked as Mrs. President. The same thing was said about Sarah Polk.
Well, they're encouraged to take on, embrace an issue, but there's a line
precisely
that you're not supposed to cross.
Exactly. Now, I think that line, fortunately, I think, but, you know, you're entitled to your own opinion. I think that line has blurred. I think it's easier for a first lady, you know, Hillary Clinton. We all remember the criticism that was voiced at Mrs. Clinton over the health care reform package with which she was associated.
Mm-hmm.
And it was never quite clear whether it was the specifics of the package or the very idea that this unelected official was taking part in public policy making. But in any event, it's part of the tightrope, quite frankly, that first ladies have always had to walk. The irony, the paradox is they are more popular than their husbands. Their memoirs sell more copies than their husbands. They become enormous political assets. But one reason why is because they're not overtly partisan. And so there's always this balancing act that's going on between, quite frankly, exploiting the popularity that they enjoy, but at the same time not damaging the brand by becoming too political.
Interesting that in some ways maybe they can do a better job of really representing the entire country than sometimes their husbands can.
Absolutely. Pat Nixon, who, again, has never really gotten the credit for many of the things she did. But when there was a terrible earthquake in Peru in 1970, and there was no plans for an official American response. And so the First Lady went into the Oval Office and said, you know, I want to go. I want to help. I want to do what I can. And on her own, she got a large airplane filled with various relief supplies and flew off to Peru and went out into the countryside. Didn't have a lot of pictures taken, didn't have press conferences, didn't, you know, try to call attention to herself or even the United States. But she and the wife of the president of Peru went out into the villages and the areas where the damage was worst, just because she wanted, you know, to be helpful.
Not every first lady has really wanted to be first lady. I think there's a story about how one of them was praying that her husband would lose the race.
Well, Jane Pierce, you know, Richard can probably talk to this a little bit more, but my reading of it is Franklin Pierce really wasn't upfront with her about running for president. She specifically did not want him to run, and we actually found a letter. Again, this is before her son Benny died, that he writes to his mother after Franklin Pierce has won the presidency, basically, and he says in the letter verbatim, "Dear Mama, I am, I know that you don't want to go to Washington, and neither do I." So even before this tragedy happens, you know, that's a first, you know, Jane Pierce is one of these women who really are not looking forward to her time in Washington. And, you know, I wasn't around then, but I assume that Washington has not always been the greatest place for a number of people.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Don and Marion, you're on the air. Welcome, Don.
Hello. How are you guys today?
Fine, thank you.
Good.
Yeah, I was just calling in about perhaps the first lady to ever be a political assassin in regards to Florence Harding maybe assassinating her husband, Warren Gamelow Harding, due to his constant philandering. I was just wondering if you guys could lend any veracity to these hometown reports.
He had a long-term relationship outside of his marriage.
He had more than one.
Okay.
And Britain's the only one we talk about.
But, you know, over the years, it's funny how these sort of urban tales live on. There was a notion that Mrs. Harding poisoned her husband so that he wouldn't have to deal with the revelations of Teapot Dome. The fact of the matter is Warren Harding was not in good health when he became president. He got taken a strenuous trip out west. He became the first president to visit Alaska. It was thought that he had eaten some tainted crab. In fact, he had a very serious heart condition and died of a heart attack or a stroke. It's still debated in a hotel room in San Francisco in August of 1923. Years later, a scoundrel named Gaston B. Means. It even sounds like, I mean,
right.
Gosh, what can you say? Central Casting.
Yeah.
Wrote a book called The Strange Death of President Harding. And the legend caught on, and it's still repeated.
Well, it wouldn't be, if it was true, the first crime of passion, but not in this case. Don, thanks for that call. If anybody else here wants to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Debbie for Mark Farkas. She asks, is C-SPAN going to spend any time at the First Lady's Museum in Canton, Ohio?
Well, yes. The answer to that is yes. The First Lady's Museum is associated with Ida McKinley in Canton, Ohio, so we'll be spending some time there. We're actually, we've got our C-SPAN bus that is traveling through Ohio this week to talk about First Ladies and to talk with high school students and college students, and they're visiting the First Lady's Museum this Saturday just to raise awareness about the series. So, yeah, we'll pay them a visit for sure.
Richard, why is it that some first ladies seem to get more leeway when it comes to speaking out and speaking their mind than others? I have an experience with Barbara Bush. I was traveling with her on the campaign trail during their first campaign, and some kid walked up to her and asked if she wanted to hear him recite the Pledge of Allegiance, which was a big deal during that race.
Yeah.
For some reason, it pops up from time to time.
Sure.
And she said, and everybody's waiting with bated breath, and she says, no, not really. And everybody just laughed. And
yes.
I thought, you know what? Could Michelle Obama get away?
Oh,
that's
a great, listen, when Betty Ford, who had been described during her husband's congressional days as a Cub Scout den mother, from Grand Rapids, well, you can hear the condescension,
yeah.
Sort of dripping, from the Washington Post. But the irony is that precisely because Mrs. Ford, or later Mrs. Bush, were thought of as traditionalists, it actually was easier for them to say things that I think you're right. I'm not sure. Mrs. Ford gave a famous interview to 60 Minutes in which she talked very candidly about premarital sex for teenagers and whether her daughter might have an affair and whether her children had tried marijuana. And, of course, she came out four square for Roe v. Wade. And, she was trying through pillow talk to get a woman on the Supreme Court, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the point is, and it touched off an uproar, but you know what? By 1976, there were campaign buttons all over America that read Betty's husband for president. And I don't think Michelle Obama, I don't know if she'd say those things or not, but I don't think she could. I'm not sure Hillary Clinton could. She got burned. Remember when she talked about You know, she wasn't a little woman standing by her man and baking cookies.
Right.
Well, the reason she got into such trouble was because I think there was already a significant part of the body politic that was inclined to look upon her as a non-traditional female. And therefore, anything she said would be, you know, would be filtered accordingly. On the other hand, hearing, it's like Mamie Eisenhower talking about abortion. You know, she never did it, but she could have in a way that I'm not sure, you know, Hillary Clinton could.
It's an interesting contrast in characters. But we mentioned earlier that some of the women, some of the first ladies didn't want to be there. And I was wondering how much, as they, you know, they live and then they pass away, but over time, do they ever befriend each other? Do they have that kind of, I mean, whoever thought that George H.W. Bush would be, you know, golfing buddies with Bill Clinton? They seem to be very supportive of each other. Is that the case for first ladies?
Oh, gosh. Let me tell you very quickly a very personal story, because President Ford had asked me to deliver the final eulogy at his funeral in Grand Rapids. And before me spoke Jimmy Carter, which a lot of people would never have predicted. But the point is, in the middle of my eulogy, I heard someone weeping. And I turned and I looked over, and it was Rosalynn Carter. And I thought to myself, whoever would have predicted in 1976 that this is how the story ends? And the fact of the matter is, after they leave their partisan political days behind them, these families do become very close. And one reason is because they're the only people in the world who have lived through the experience of living in the White House, bringing up children in the White House. And against that, you know, partisan loyalties seem insignificant. So the Carters and the Fords became very close. The Bushes and the Clintons are very close. And I think it's a safe bet that one day the Obamas will likewise find themselves very close with their with the other members of what Herbert Hoover called our exclusive trade union.
And we did an interview with Michelle Obama, and we talked to her about which first ladies does she look back to for guidance throughout history. And, you know, she really focused on the modern first ladies, and there was no distinction between party. You know, she talked about looking back to Lady Bird Johnson and Pat Nixon, Nancy Reagan. So, Richard's right, it's a very small sorority of women who have played this role, and presidents, obviously, to broaden it out, that I think it does transcend party lines.
How our first ladies, first spouses may come to be the term in the future, but
yeah,
how are they prepared for the role? We always hear about the royal family in England, and they have all of these people there that teach them how they're supposed to act when a new person joins the family. What do we do here?
The simplest answer is they're not.
Huh.
I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is, for presidents and first ladies alike, I don't care what your resume, there is on-the-job training. Because, again, as I said earlier, so much of the job is dealing with the unexpected. Now, that said, for example, if you've been the wife of a governor, you have all kinds of practical experience in an executive role. In some ways, that's probably the closest thing to practical preparation. One of the things we haven't mentioned, this series is actually a collaboration with the White House Historical Association, and we did a number of interviews, the only ones I believe that exist as a group. We interviewed all 14 living White House social secretaries.
Ah.
And they get together as a group every time there is a new social secretary to break them in and to share war stories. But there isn't. That doesn't happen with the first ladies. They don't all get together and welcome the newest member to the sorority.
But don't they usually invite the sitting first lady, for lack of a better phrase, sitting first
sure.
lady, the incoming first lady?
They do. Know. They do. But under the best of circumstances, I mean, sometimes that, frankly, is a rather brittle encounter.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine imagine that your husband just defeated her husband,
mm-hmm.
and and because of that, you and your family have to move out, they can be somewhat chilly. There are wonderful stories, which we'll incorporate in the series. Some of those encounters have been warmer than others.
We have an email from John in Hilliard. He asks, is it true that Woodrow Wilson's second wife played an important role in running the country after her husband's stroke?
Depends on how you define running.
Mm-hmm.
What she did, and it's certainly significant, she controlled all access to the president. She decided, ultimately, who saw him, what paperwork went into him, and the like. Now, that's a role maybe akin to a chief of staff in a modern context, but it's a far cry from the old notion that she's the first female president, of the United States.
But that's a lot of power when you think about it.
And then real quick, we have an email from Carol. Is it true that Mrs. Andrew Johnson taught President Johnson to read?
Yeah, I wish she taught him politics, but we'll leave it at that.
But she did teach him to read?
Yeah, she was. I believe she was a teacher, and he was. I mean, he was this self-made. Born in a cabin, and I believe she was part of his education.
Mark Farkas, the series. It's a 2-season series.
Mm-hmm.
It starts this weekend, and it ends in the first season ends in June.
Yes, season one starts Monday night.
Okay.
And then we will go every Monday night at 9 p.m. on C-SPAN, taking on each individual First Lady as we go forward chronologically, ending in June with Ida McKinley, and then we'll take the summer off, and then season two begins with Edith Roosevelt and really gets into the modern era of First Ladies and ends the following President's Day in 2014 as we go all the way to Michelle Obama.
Well, looking forward to DVRing it. And
don't forget, you don't have to DVR if you don't want. Go on our website, cspan.org/firstladies. And that's another thing. When we produce these series now, the website is absolutely just as important as the television programs for people who want to watch the programs, at their leisure or in their own way. There are shorter clips on the website, and there's not a lot of great resources out there on First Ladies. And so the website for us is a real opportunity.
We'll post that website on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Mark Farkas, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Mark Farkas is the executive producer of the C-SPAN special series, First Ladies, Influence, and Image. And also, Richard Norton Smith, very nice talking with you today. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Richard Norton Smith is a presidential historian at George Mason University and an advisor to C-SPAN for its historical programs, including First Ladies, Influence, and Image. Thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks to the staff of All Sides, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producers Corinne Gleckler, Rachel Quimby, production assistants Karim Shaban, Rose Joe, and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.